Okay, good morning, everyone. Welcome to this month's Guild Call. I'm excited to get started here. So I'll be sharing a little bit about the writing process for your first 1,000 copies because that was the book for this month, and then we'll dive into the Q&A. Also, before we get started, I just want to let everybody know a couple different things. So first off, we're in, we're quickly coming up on month 10 of the guild, which seems crazy that it's already this far into it. And in November, we're going to be offering a chance to jump in for year two with some changes, some additions, and a really, really cool giveaway that I'm very excited about. I just got a little peek at it yesterday. So that's going to be coming up in November. If you haven't yet filled out the survey, I think it's in the forum. Maybe we'll pin it to the top, but it's in the forum. We've emailed it out. But if you could fill that out, we are wanting to make sure we get everybody's input as we decide exactly what it's going to look like for next year. Also, exciting, we're coming up obviously on the 10th month of StoryGrid Publishing as well. And it's been a huge learning curve for me. And it's been really fun. It's been mostly fun running everything and trying to keep all the trains on time. And to that end, we are bringing on Leslie Watts as our editor in chief. So
Yay.
she officially starts tomorrow, but she actually started a while ago. And I'm just so excited to have somebody that's in charge of that and keeping us on schedule and making sure our books turn out nice. So excited to have Leslie join the team. Yeah, I think that was it. Valerie, was there any other announcements that I should make before we jump in?
Nope, that's everything.
All right. Okay, so since this month's book was your first 1,000 copies, the second edition, we decided I would share a little bit at the beginning and then we can get into the Q&A. It was interesting because this was the first time I wrote a book without having, first time since coming to StoryGrid and learning StoryGrid and then writing a book without having Sean look at every chapter as I wrote it, which is a little scary. And so I just wanted to share some things that I found helpful and useful and interesting along the way that maybe you guys will agree or get something out of. So first off, it kind of came up quick on me. We had a book drop out for September, and so Sean called me because I told him back in the spring that I was working on the second edition of your first 1,000 copies. But what I didn't tell him is like a week after I told him I was working on it, I stopped working on it. So he called me and he's like, "Yeah, you were working on that, right?" And I was like, "Yeah." And he's like, "You think you could have it done by next week?" I'm like, "Probably." And so, and I'm doing it, I did a complete rewrite. So I wasn't using hardly anything from the previous book. So page one rewrite, and I'll talk about that in a second. And so I pulled up my draft and I had only written 12,000 words and I knew it was going to be over 30,000 words and I had 6 days. And so I wrote, whatever that is, an average of, over 2,000 words a day. And I just cranked through it. And at the end of it, I realized like I could have done this on almost any other week. I didn't not have anything to do that week. And I've been talking about writing the second edition for literally years, 2 or 3 years. And so it just kind of struck me that when all of a sudden I had to write it, I just wrote it and it was done 6 days later and I turned it in. And so for me, it was just this kind of wake up call of like, I had time when I needed to have time. And again, it was a normal week. it wasn't any less busy or more busy than any other week. And I realized, like, you know, out of 52 weeks in a year, probably 45 of those I could have pulled this off. And so it was just this, like, you know, I have this space in my life that I don't give to the writing that I could. Now, I don't think I could sustain that forever, but I just realized there's more time than, and this actually dovetails with about a week before this, I had started writing 500 words a day because we did that interview with Mike McClellan, the author of The CNC, and he just talked about how he writes 500 words a day. And I was like, you know, I had this in my head that if I'm going to write, it has to be at least 1,000 words. It should be like 2,000 words a day that I'm writing. And somehow, like, dropping that number to 500, where, like, if I'm in the middle of a scene, so when I start, I know exactly what I'm going to write next. It's like 20 to 30 minutes tops. And so this morning was, let's see, I have an app that I keep track of it, actually. Obvious, you know, something I would do. Today was day 57 in a row that I've written at least 500 words a day. And I'm just like, it's just that simple. And it's even been as simple as, like, it's time for bed. I didn't write yet. I just take 25 minutes and knock it out before I go to bed. It doesn't have to be coherent. It just has to be my 500 words on the book. And so that's been a big shift for me, that this rewriting your first 1,000 copies came real close to the beginning of me kind of committing to that and just realizing I have the time. The other thing that I felt like made this easy is how much I have talked about this stuff out loud. So, you know, I came out with the book, the first edition of the book, in 2013, but I've continued to teach it. I run webinars, I have online courses, I teach workshops, I teach at Mastermind. Like, I'm always teaching this stuff from different angles. And it reminded me of, like, Stephen King has talked, I think it was in On Writing, he talked about, like, taking somebody out to coffee and just telling them your story verbally. My client, Daniel Pink, who's a multi-time New York Times bestselling author of nonfiction, he reads his books out loud to his wife, which, you know, I don't know if Candace would be able to put up with that, but he reads it out loud, and one, to get her advice, but also to force himself to read it out loud. And it constantly, and he's always, as he's coming up with the ideas, he's always talking to his friends about it and discussing it. And I realized, like, I could sit down and kind of burn through this because I knew exactly what I was going to say because I've said it so many times. I just had to write it down now. So that's the other thing. So probably the biggest kind of breakthrough for me was figuring out the narrative device of the book. So when I was thinking, the biggest criticism about the first edition was people saying it doesn't work for fiction, or I wrote it for nonfiction. And, you know, I always bristled at that because, of course, you know, if somebody's criticizing my book, I'm going to bristle. But when I went back and read it, because the first thing I did when Sean called me was read the old version. And I'm like, first of all, this is not written very well. Second of all, like, 80% of the examples were nonfiction examples, because that's who I had done most of my work with at the time. And so when I started thinking through, like, how I wanted to put this across, it's like every time I thought about just writing it in a way of, like, if you have this problem, then you do this, and then you'll run into this problem, then you'll do this. It felt kind of patronizing, and it also felt like I couldn't get really specific about the kind of problems that we've run into, that so many of the authors I've worked with have run into. And so what I decided to do was create two characters for the book, and I introduced them in the introduction. One of them's a fiction writer. One of them's a nonfiction writer. One of them is, the nonfiction writer is somewhat established. The fiction writer starting from scratch, which is also kind of two things I deal with a lot with authors. And then the whole book became coaching them. And what made that really fun is I could just have them say stuff that I've heard so many times that if I just wrote down, like, here's what people say to me. Like, there's one particular part. And because if you know, I've been there. I even get stuck in these loops. But if you've ever gone down the marketing rabbit hole, you'll like start Googling stuff and then reading stuff, and you lose like 2 hours of your life or more and realize like that was a complete waste of time. So I got to like have this, relate this phone call with this character where they called me freaking out because that's what they just did and they're overwhelmed and now they feel like they can't do anything. And I've had that conversation so many times, but the only way to really relate it is to relate the conversation. And so that, you know, I still, if you go back to any episodes where we've talked about narrative device, it's always been a really hard thing for me to wrap my head around. And I honestly still think it's a hard thing for me to wrap my head around. But in that particular, I did it. And then I realized like, oh, that's a narrative device. That made it easy to tell my story because I had somebody to speak through. So that was probably the biggest kind of breakthrough on the book that let me, and this is what, you know, Sean's talked about so many times, is like once you get that narrative device down, this, it becomes really easy to tell the story because you have this really clear perspective. So getting to like, you know, anytime I came into a book where I needed to talk about something, I would just, you know, make up this conversation with one of these two characters and have them tell me their problem. And then I could tell people how to solve that problem. And the first review on Amazon of the second edition was like exactly what I wanted, which is somebody saying, I read the first edition, couldn't figure out how it applied to fiction, read the second edition, he fixed that problem. I now know what to do, you know? So that was just awesome. Applying the five commandments to nonfiction it just works really, really well. And what's nice about all the work I've done with StoryGrid is now being able to write from that perspective. Like it's just become automatic where I know in the introduction, I'm setting up the inciting incident, which, you know, for the nonfiction character, she got a new book contract. For the fiction character, he's about to publish his book and realize he has no idea how to do any marketing. So there's an inciting incident. And then it even helped me figure out what order to put things in. I was actually going to flip around the order from the original book. And I realized like, no, outreach is the final thing I talk about. That's always the hardest, biggest problem for every single author. And so I need to keep that at the end because I have to build to that. So the final kind of progressive complication is having to do outreach. And so being able to think through the book in the terms of the five commandments worked really, really well. And again, one of those things that I hadn't really thought much of, because the other nonfiction I had written was Running Down a Dream, which was almost a memoir, right? So it was just me telling my story, where this is not a memoir, but it's still, so it was interesting to me to see how the StoryGrid principles still worked in writing a how-to book without it just being this, me just like dumping a bunch of information on the person, the reader. Let's see. So a couple technical things that I figured out between the two books. So one thing when writing nonfiction, especially how to, is walking this line of being specific, but not writing a book that's going to quickly go out of date. So, you know, when I wrote, I did a little bit of this in the original edition, but I think I've really figured out how to thread the needle on this one. But you're wanting to be as specific as you can. Because at first when I started writing it, I wasn't going to put in anything about Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, because I'm always afraid those things are going to shift and change and go away, right? Like if I had done this, if I'd gotten specific 3 months ago, maybe I would have mentioned TikTok, you know, and now that might be going away forever. So I get nervous mentioning specific platforms, but I felt like, no, you know, for me to be specific enough, I have to mention these platforms. So I stuck to the ones that will probably be around a long time. It's going to be hard to beat YouTube. But at the same time, when I got into specific tools when I got into any kind of statistics, I tried to just give my point of view and then use the footnotes to point to specific articles, because that way I can shift those footnote. I can like shift to newer articles in the future if I want to keep it up to date. So anything that I thought might change in the next, you know, 2 to 4 years, I shifted to EndNotes and linked out. And the other thing I did is I put all of the resources on one page. So in the past, I like set up like all these different pages for all these different links out. And now I have like 7 pages or 10 pages floating out there that I got to keep up to date. Again, this is just super practical, technical things. But inside of StoryGrid Publishing, we already put up a resources page for every book, right? So for the Masterwork Guides and Contender Guides, you can download the infographic and spreadsheet and all of that. And so I just put everything on one page. And then throughout the entire book, I just pointed to that page over and over and over, so that if I ever needed to update anything, the link would stay the same. I would just have to change one page on the website. So I'm always thinking about with projects, like just, you know, what am I going to have to keep up to date 10 years from now? Or what am I, you know, I want something that has me doing as little as possible down the road. The other thing is that I felt like, you know, going back to the nonfiction course that Sean taught back in February, you know, at one point I forgot, somebody asked what the villain of nonfiction is, and you know, I don't remember exactly what Sean said, but it was basically like ignorance or the unknown, right? And so it was a lot of times when you read how to and self-help, it feels like you're sitting across the table from the author and the author's telling you what to do. And so again, going back to the narrative device, it allowed me to become, to kind of come to the other side of the table and sit shoulder to shoulder with the reader, and say like, okay, you know, here's a problem that authors face. Let's walk through this together and figure out the best way to do it. Now, obviously I'm the expert here, so you're reading the book, you know, for my point of view, but it allows me to kind of unfold it in this way where we're going to beat this together. And so, and I think early on, I know one of my biggest fears with the first book was that people were going to read it and think I was stupid and think my advice didn't work. And so I felt like I wrote the book in this, I don't know if you would get it as confrontational when you read it, but I remember writing it in this confrontational way of like trying to have this like, okay, well, they might say this doesn't work, so I need to back up my argument this way. And they might say this doesn't work, so I'm going to back up my argument this way. And then I've just learned over, you know, the years that it's really hard to argue with somebody's story. Right. So you can argue with, you know, somebody says 2 plus 2 is 5, you know, it's pretty easy to argue with that. But if somebody's just telling you their story of something they've gone through and where their point of view came from, it's really hard to argue with that. And it's hard to argue, not because your argument's so strong, it's because it's a disarming way to get your point across. And so that's where approaching this book, I really tried to just, I even put a couple mistakes that I've made with my own books in the book and just said, you know, I ran into this problem with this, with, you know, when I went to market Running Down a Dream. And so, that really helped me, again, the switch, you know, when I wrote Running Down a Dream, it was very much memoir, come along with me as I keep my life from burning down. And then this is like, no, I'm coming in as the expert. Like, this isn't about me, like, you know, failing for years as a marketing person and then finally triumphing, you know, but putting my characters out there as the people that are triumphing and then me just walking alongside of them and basically playing the mentor role as they grow, but letting them make their own decisions, totally changed the tone of the book. And I felt like it allowed me to put a lot of the StoryGrid principles into something that would normally just be a, you know, how to. So
That's it.
Hopefully that was helpful to you. It was a lot of fun to write, and it felt, I've never gone into a book with such confidence. One, because I know the subject material well, but also I knew it was the first time I knew what I felt like I knew what I was doing when I started writing. So, so that was cool. Sean, you want me to just talk about the Sand Sea stuff now?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Okay. So, kind of totally different topic. So we wanted to give some, you know, this is on the topic of marketing, so I think it's interesting around the topic of your first 1,000 copies, but also, you know, we came out with the Sand Sea and we did the big kind of give the book away to as many people that will take it to drive both early reviews, but also we just wanted people to read the book, right? Our goal at StoryGrid is not to build front list bestsellers, it's to build, you know, backlist longtime sellers. And the way that you do that is just, you know, getting the first 10,000 people to give the book a try. So we did that push, but that's basically all we did to market the book. And the first encouraging sign was that most of the reviews were good. You know, I'm always, whenever I'm working with an author, or especially on my own books, I'm always holding my breath for those first couple dozen reviews. Because even if they're 4 or 5 stars, but you read them and you can tell like people are just being nice. So I was really encouraged by that. But then what was really neat was we stopped all promotion of the book because we had done, as the publisher, everything that we could do. And then Mike was still trying to kind of figure out what he was going to do. And so for 6 weeks or so, there was no marketing of the book, no promotion of the book, and the book kept selling. And so we sold many days. We sold into 2 digits a book, so over 10 books, copies a day. We've sold a lot of hardcover at $35, which is really nice because the margin's so much higher on those. And the book just was selling. And so the only way that it could be selling if somebody was telling somebody else to buy the book. So that was a really good early sign for me as the marketing guy of, is the book selling on its own? Because I've worked on a lot of books where we do a huge campaign, then we stop, and then all sales stop at that point, right? So we need the book to be able to sell without us pushing every sell. Because, you know, I want to sell 1 million copies of the Sand Sea. Well, we could like shove 10,000 copies down people's throat, right? Like we could do marketing, we could push it, but there's no way that we can possibly sell 1 million copies just by pushing the book. The book will have to do it on its own through word of mouth. And so the fact that there were early signs that people were telling other people to buy the book was really encouraging. And so then Mike has a friend that does some Facebook advertising. So they've been testing a bunch of different Facebook advertising, and that's been working pretty well. And this whole time, the book has been priced at $34.99 for the hardcover and $9.99 for the ebook. And the reason we priced the $9.99 at the ebook is because with Kindle, if you get 70% of royalties if you price the book between $2.99 and $9.99. If you price the book higher or lower than that, you only get 35% of the royalties. So it's basically Amazon strong-arming you into charging $9.99 for your book at most. So he's been running ads. They were working pretty well. He was using some of the reviews that we've gotten. He used Steve Pressfield's quote. And then I wanted to try out just doing a price promotion for the book. And so I tried to get a BookBub, but we got turned down for that, which is super frustrating because they never tell you why you got turned down. So I'm just going to put back in for that. And for those that don't know, BookBub is this service where as a reader, you can go sign up and tell them what genres you read. And every day you'll get an email with a deal on a book in the genres that you read, right? So it's either free or I think the highest it goes is $2.99, but most of them are 99 cents. And then because they have this huge email list of all these readers, they sell those spots, right? So then I can put in and say, hey, we have an epic fantasy novel. and then we become the deal of the day in that genre. So I put in for that. We got turned down, but I was like, well, let me still do this. So there's a bunch of smaller versions of BookBub, a lot smaller. But I did three of those. Two of them came out yesterday. One of them came out today or will come out today. We dropped the price to 99 cents on Monday, right? Today. Yeah. On Monday. And right now we're sitting at like the top, it dropped below 1,000. We were in the top 1,000 last night. I think we'll drop below that again today. So we made it into the top 1,000 on Kindle. We're like number 6 in historical fiction right now on Kindle, which is really cool. We've sold over 300 copies of the ebook since I dropped the price on Monday. So that's been really cool. We're also, you know, we're just trying out all these different things to continue. Again, our goal as the publisher is to get the book into 10,000 people's hands. And so we're actually going, our next thing is we're going to try to get it. You can put into BookBub every 4 weeks if you get turned down. So we're going to try that again in a couple weeks. If we get turned down, we're going to just pick a day. Right now we're looking at December 10th. And we're just going to put as much into it as we can. So all the kind of mini book bubs, the small book bubs, we're going to buy up December 10th on all of those that we possibly can. We're going to run a bunch of advertising. We'll email both the smaller list of people that got the art copies, but also the larger list, the larger story grid list. We'll try to get some other people to email on that day. And I have this outside goal of, I'd love to sell like 3,000 to 5,000 copies in a couple days is my goal. So, so that's, you know, that's just what we're doing around the CNC. Cause we're kind of using the CNC to figure out what kind of marketing and promotion we are doing as a publishing house. You know, Sean and I agree, we should have done the giveaway, the ARC giveaway for the threshing. We think that would have helped it early on. But you know, obviously we're learning as we go, but this is really giving us a roadmap because I mean, my goal would be that, you know, by day one, when, by the day the book comes out, we've exposed the book to 10,000 people have read the first page. That's my goal as the publisher. You know, as a guy that's been doing marketing for so long, I don't feel like it should be the author's responsibility to do all the marketing. And right now, whether you're traditionally published or self-published, you know, 99.9% of the marketing falls on your shoulders. And I feel like it's like the weirdest thing. It's like saying, in order to learn to play the guitar, you have to be able to fix a carburetor. Like, it's just two completely different skill sets, but yet we're forcing authors to do both of those skill sets. So my goal with StoryGrid Publishing will be that, you know, we can provide, especially, you know, if the author wants to help, if the author wants to get in the mix like Mike is doing, that's awesome. But we, you know, we want to be able to have a platform that we can expose a book to 10,000 readers on day one, and then, you know, let the book roll from there. So I think that kind of covers everything, Sean.
Yeah, that's great. That's exactly, hold on a sec. That's exactly what I wanted you to cover, because it's important for everybody to know that this is a work in progress, and we are constantly trying to get a higher resolution of our publishing skills. So I can't express how, because when you talk to civilians who are not in book publishing, and you go, hey, you know, this really great thing happened. Oh, well, what happened? Well, we're number 6 on the Amazon Kindle list for epic fantasy fiction. Oh, good. But to get there is not easy at all. And the fact that this happened, you know, 12 weeks after we released the book is remarkable to me. So, and also the fact we have 282 reviews for a first novel from somebody nobody's ever heard of. So I am just so, and it's the first epic fantasy novel I've ever edited. So it's pretty remarkable. And I'm not going to take any credit for the marketing because it came from Tim, Mike, and Mike's friend, or I don't even know. And that's the good thing too, because it's like, there's a lot of people who help that the publisher doesn't even need to know about. So that's just remarkable. It's the most competitive genre to get any traction whatsoever because the readership is so dedicated. You can't bullshit the fantasy readership. So anyway, I think it's a great start. It's the first book in a million word epic series. So I was very, very, very nervous about publishing it well, doing a good job. And there's miles and miles to go, but it's extremely encouraging. So, with that said, let's transition into your questions. Is the chat open so that people can drop them in? Can we get that going? Okay, cool.
Chat should be open. So you can post. Oh, I have it turned off. Hold on. Everyone public. That's from the last time. All right, everyone, you should be able to chat now. Sorry, I had that turned off. But I have a couple of questions here submitted ahead of time. And then if you have questions, you can drop them in the chat as well. All right, here's one. I've been having a really hard time with my revisions lately. I'm at the point where I know what isn't working in my novel, but I'm stuck on how to fix it. Can you talk about what you do when you figured out the problem but are drawing a blank on solutions?
I think usually that's a symptom of impatience. And I think it's so difficult just to find the problems that once you actually find the problems, then it becomes, oh my God, look at this laundry list of shit I've got to take care of. I don't know where to start. And then you start getting, you start narrowing your focus and start worrying about things that are really not stuff to worry about. So, all right, let's say you've got a list of say 150 issues with your manuscript. Well, what do you do? Well, use levels of analysis to begin with. So basically you don't want to just like when we're editing Tim's novel, I had him put all these issues on the side when he went through his spreadsheet, and I didn't have him try and fix any of them. I just wanted him to go scene by scene, mark the problems that he saw were there. And then after he did that, we did have a list of at least 150, maybe more. And then knowing that, then we started using levels of analysis in order to flush out a lot of things that could get in the way of doing specific work. So levels of analysis, what do I mean? Okay, the first thing would be run your genre obligatory scenes and obligatory moments and conventions. Are you hitting those moments? Could they be better? So you want to start with the stuff that is really super important. The stuff that will move a book from not working to working. Okay, what's that? Nobody's going to be surprised when I answer this. Genre, 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 right? So you go to your core genre and you say, you just go back to first principles. What's this fucking thing about? What's the genre? What's the global genre? And if you go, this is a crime story. Okay, cool. Crime story. Perfect. So the global value is about justice and injustice. Great. Let me check. At the beginning, is there an injustice? Yes. At the end, has there been a change to justice or a change into worse injustice, right? So it can move from a negative to a double negative, or it can move from a negative to a positive, or it can move to a negative plus and minus, right? A paradoxical, Dennis Lehane writes these kind of books, where justice is served, but it's not really universally morally great. Okay. So that's where you start. Start with your genre. And if you find, oh, my beginning has a great injustice, but it's a little murky at the end. I'm not really sure. The reader might not know that, you know, the perpetrator was discovered, the perpetrator was revealed, et cetera, et cetera. So that's where you start. You start with the big questions, and then you go into the subcomponents of your genre. And what are those? The conventions and the obligatory moments. Am I hitting the conventions? Are there a lot of red herrings? Are there, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? And then once you go, okay, well, I've got a beginning and my end, and I've got all this stuff that's kind of percolating in the middle, you know, it essentially is getting closer to working. Then you start saying, are these parts innovative? Are they interesting? Are they surprising? Am I turning scenes in a way that are unexpected? But you can see where I'm going here. What I'm talking about is when you start editing your work, you want to start at the really high abstract meta level. You want to look at this thing globally. Why? Well, because your instinct is to work micro. Why? Because micro is easier to solve. Micro, you can fix a sentence, and it's fun to fix a sentence because you can tweak it, right? It's fun to tweak. But you can spend year after year after year tweaking sentences, and if the macro doesn't work, it's a waste of time. So your instinct is to just want to go down your 150 problems and solve those micro problems. But instead, what you have to do is ask yourself some very difficult questions. Why did I write this? What's this about? What's the controlling idea? What's the point of view? What are the six core editor questions? Can I answer these questions? Can the reader clearly be able to answer them for me if I handed them these six questions? It's a great rubric, right? If I hand my manuscript to someone and ask them to read it, and then after they finish, I hand them the six core questions, will they be able to answer them? And they don't have to give you like perfect story grid answers. It could just be like, what's this story about? Well, it's about a crime, I think. Great. And was there a change? Oh, yeah, absolutely. They got the guy at the end. Was it surprising? Yeah, I was totally, I didn't know it was going to be that person. Then you start seeing whether or not the thing works. So the editing process, the last thing you want to do is start tweaking sentences. That's like draft 12. That's the final thing. I don't even do it anymore. I give it to Leslie and she does it. Because it's really important, but it's not that important, right? So I can focus on macro issues. And when you find a great line editor, they can help you with the micro. So it's not even, but our tendency when we're writing is to worry so much about those sentences. And it's really distracting, and it's a way to get lost. And so that's what I think is going on when you say, I'm really overwhelmed by my revisions. I don't know what to do. Well, just go back to the six core editor questions. Ask yourself, is this surprising? Is it interesting? Do I actually have a controlling idea here? Does it make sense? And then you can then go down to the next level. Let me check out my obligatory moments and my conventions. Am I hitting those? Are they that good, right? Can I improve them? So say you're hitting them all, right? Then you could say, well, this is sort of like the hero at the mercy of the villain scene, and he brings out a gun and shoots him. Okay, that's okay, but it's not really that great. It's okay. So then you can fix it and be like, instead of a gun, he finds, adhesive tape, and he throws a ball at, I don't know, right? Just spitball it, figure it out, make them better. Do something that nobody else has done before. Don't be satisfied with, you know, mimicking the scene from Die Hard for the 3,000th time. Use the scene from Die Hard as a placeholder. Write it that way. Use your character. Fine. Totally cool. Rip it all off. And then while you're editing, then you can really start tweaking them. Can I take this sort of cliche scene and up a notch? Can I come up with something fresh? So macro, 6 core editor questions, and just use that until you can't do it anymore.
All right. Here's one from Owen. What are the rules concerning dropping company names and trademarks in a story? For instance, the hero pulled the guy out of the Ford and popped him so hard he flew out of his Crocs, grabbed the Ruger, charged into Walmart to clear out the zombies. Is it allowed to use these names in fiction?
Yeah. If these are global brand names, Tom Clancy, he made a fortune just dropping in a lot of technology with that specificity, like describing the Ruger and the way, you know, the firing pin worked and all that stuff. So I think it can become a real crutch though, and it can become distracting to the reader. There's a famous novel, American Psycho, right? So when Bret Easton Ellis wrote that, I think it was a visionary novel that at the time people didn't really get. And so he wrote, and all he talked about were like the brand names that Patrick Bateman, I think, was the protagonist, all the brand names that this guy was so fascinated by. So he would put on his X shirt and his Louis Vuitton wallet. And so he loaded it with so many brand names that I think Michiko Kakutani, when she reviewed it for the Times, said something like, this is like the J. Crew catalog. This isn't a novel. But now you kind of see like what Ellis was up to is, you know, it's like when you're obsessed with consumerism, you slowly become sociopathological. So, he really sledgehammered that motif, no doubt. So that's the problem. You don't want to get it to the point where people are like, geez, I don't really care about the brand name of this car any longer. But if it's a crucial character device where that character is obsessively concerned with the make and model of their stuff, then it can work. Then it can be really kind of fascinating. There's some great horror novels about, psychopaths who have very meticulous dedication to David Cronenberg. I don't even want to bring up, I think it was called Twins. It was a really sick movie, but that character was obsessed with certain medical devices to the point it was nauseating. So it can work as a characterization element. So I'm not saying don't do it, as long as you are using a super duper brand name that is in the public domain. In the United States, it's kind of fair game. So it can get hinky when you're in the UK. So libel laws are a lot different. So just be careful, but generally okay.
Well, like a big one that comes to mind for me is Ready Player One, because there was so much 80s nostalgia, and that's what made the book, like, it created the world for the book.
Yeah, and there's that funny thing in Ghostbusters where they came up with the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, which was a really great, innovative moment. You know, that's totally Dan Aykroyd. You know, what is the most ridiculously like soft and fuzzy thing we can think of to become the epitome of evil, and it's like the Marshmallow Man.
Yeah.
Anyway.
All right. Question about Fear Gorillas. So this is from the Hero's Journey Fantasy course from a couple of weeks ago. It occurred to me that I'd come up with a way of thinking about them, but I had not verified that my idea matched what Sean meant. Invisible fear gorillas are fear gorillas that the protagonist or luminary agent in a given scene or sequence is unaware of or not fully aware of, while visible fear gorillas are the ones a character in question is aware of and is trying on some level to cope with. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think that's pretty good. I think that's really good. there's some nuance, but generally I think that's a really good heuristic. What I really love about the concept of the invisible gorilla experiment is that it's just so it can really, it's sticky. So it's sticky in your mind about asking yourself, is the unexpected event in this scene invisible or visible? That's question number one. Can the protagonist actually see the thing that has occurred? So that's a great thing to actually make you even consider the fact that there's something unexpected actually happened, right? So those unexpected things are the engine that will turn, will bring you to turning point. But I think that's really good. So the visible fear gorilla is the one that the protagonist of the scene has identified. So if I need to go across my lawn to get my lawnmower and my kid has left all of this stuff in the yard and I can't mow the lawn until I clear it, it's a visible, unexpected event. If I'm walking out, I've got a goal. My goal state is to have a cut yard. And when I go out to the yard, my kid has his bike and all that crap on the yard. Then that's a visible fear gorilla, right? It's an unexpected event and I have to do something about it. Now I can do a bunch of things about it, right? I can move the stuff myself. I could call my son or my daughter and say, get this shit out of the yard before I cut the yard. And not only that, you have to cut the yard, right? So all these things can happen, but the important thing is that there's an unexpected event, right? Now, here's the invisible fear gorilla, and this actually happened to me when I was 14 and had a lawn cutting business. So I was cutting a lawn, and this still gives me great pain to discuss, but I'm going to do it anyway. All right, so I was cutting a lawn, and I ran over something, and I heard a lot of horrific screaming. And so it's an invisible fear gorilla. I didn't know anything was there. And then when I looked down, it was a nest of bunnies. And it was horrific because I had to euthanize them because they were in horrible pain, right? And I'll never forget, I just wanted to run away screaming because I was terrified that I was so sad and upset. But I did also know it would be crueler not to put them out of their misery. So there's an invisible fear gorilla cutting a lawn that can be extraordinarily traumatic. And that's a means by which, so those are the different kind of fear gorillas. Junk in the yard that you have to clear in order to get the job done. Or while you're doing the job, something unexpected happens that requires turning off the lawnmower, finding a hoe, killing the bunnies, and then fucking burying the bunnies in a proper burial mound. And then telling the owner, oh, by the way, I slaughtered 6 baby bunnies in your yard accidentally, and I had to dig that hole. I put grass, blah, 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 right? So that's a really good way of looking at it. And I hope that is sticky enough for everyone. Maybe it's bloody bunny, you know, fear event. I don't know. Maybe we found a new rubric here. So sorry for that disturbing story, but it happened.
Now I want to stick with the gorillas. I'm not okay. I don't wanna go with, all right. This one's from Thomas. As a writer drawn especially to stories centered in internal genres, I've been thinking about this question. To what degree can we identify particular overarching principles and dynamics that are normally present in all internal genres, but which are not particularly vital to the external genres? These would be special story qualities related to internalness that really set apart the best internal genre stories of all stripes, in which readers who enjoy internally driven stories will be expecting, even if they wouldn't consciously identify which particularly internal genre or subgenre this story belongs to. Are the specific differences between the various internal genres and subgenres overwhelmingly more important for the writer's focus and awareness, so much that any internal, quote, universals don't matter much? I think that does it.
Okay, this is this gets to the heart of what's called the mind-body problem, okay? So when I originally came up with StoryGrid, I was not really interested in thinking about internality versus externality as a phenomena or philosophical problem to explore. All I wanted to do was to categorize stories in such a way that could be the most helpful in order to identify the global values at stake so that writers would know what kind of change would have to occur in their global story. So the notion of the interior story versus the exterior story is, in my estimation, right now for me, it's a problematic one. Why? Well, because there is no difference. For every internal story has to have an external dimension, and every external story has to have an internal dimension. And the reason is that our bodies and our minds are completely enmeshed. They're coupled. So Descartes famously said, "I think, therefore I am." And he was sort of trying to rationalize the rise of the Enlightenment and scientific methodology of objective standards of externality. So the question, the way I'm reading the question is, what are the universalities of interiority that are different from exteriority? And there are none. And the reason why is that we need the mind and the body to be coupled. So when I just did the heroic journey, my proposition was that the means by which we accomplish that in a story is by having an on-the-surface component to each scene, which would be your action, body, motor action stuff, right? What the characters are literally doing. And you needed to have a worldview component, an above-the-ground component in the scene. What does that mean? That means the character needs to have an intention. They need to have a tactical worldview intention that will drive their motor action. So when you're talking about being drawn to interior stories, you're talking about worldview shifts. So a worldview shift could be something like a redemption story, where somebody believes that the world's shit and nothing is ever worth anything, and then they're abusive to other people. And then at the end of the story, they come to the realization that there is meaning, like how the Grinch stole Christmas. There's a redemption story. That's a worldview shift story. That's an internal story, but there's a lot of great externality in that story embedded, correct? Right? Because the Grinch has to enact his worldview. He enacts his psychopathology at the beginning by stealing all the stuff. And by the end, he's cutting the roast beast, right? So his actions are portraying his worldview shift. So when you say, are there just worldview shift stories without action, without externality? No. The famous Irish guy, you know, Finnegan's Wake, James Joyce, right? So even in those hyper intellectual internal things, the whole process is about that character trying to attune their body and their mind. So all I can say is that all the questions about the universal principles and internal stories are completely embedded in the heroic journey stuff that I just did, and they're embedded in the obligatory moments and conventions of the worldview, morality, and status genres. So obviously I'm working on writing the Heroic Journey 2.0 book, which will really delineate this stuff in hopefully a very clear way. But basically, this is the biggest freaking problem. This is one of the greatest philosophical problems that has yet to be kind of fully resolved. And so the mind-body connection and coupling, our minds are not separate from our bodies. Why? Because all the input that goes into our minds comes from our body. And then our body directs our mind directs our body. So it all goes to like the agent arena relationship and our relationship, not only from our mind and our body, but our mind, body, and environment, right? So it's a trinity of coupled relationships that have a nested quality that affect one another. I know I'm speaking very abstractly, but I would steer clear of the notion that there is a difference between external and internal stories, because all externally driven action is driven from internal worldview of your character, and all worldview shifts are driven by enacted behavior in the story. So yeah, that's the best answer I can give right now.
Okay. This one's from Mark. The Western has come up as a point of contention sometimes due to its name and its American-centered implication. I wondered if it might fit better as a subgenre category of the society genre.
The ontology of story grid genre definitions is certainly fluid. It probably could be. Usually, what happens when you see a global emergence of a larger category of story is by the collective cultural grammar. The collective cultural grammar in the 1950s was from what emerged the Western as a massive category of story. So I think it served a very big purpose at the time because, we were essentially in a moment where we had mass culture. It was difficult to figure out the place of the individual in society. So what do people do? They get nostalgic. And they say, oh, remember the day when it was just open land and, you know, the intrepid individualist could just go out in there and make a name for themselves. And then so at that time in the United States and actually all over the world, because all of those Westerns translated across the world. And there is the Eastern too. And A Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon is my sort of definition of what I would call an Eastern, which is about the same thing. It's about a repressed agentic person inside of a collective cultural grammar that is constraining them to the point where they cannot apply agency. So in Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, it's about the complete constraints that were upon women that refused to let them emerge as the agentic, brilliant figures that they could be. and it's a tragic ending, but that, so it's not just about that specific example. Other Eastern stories are about the individual as opposed to the cultural grammar that's constraining them. And it's the same thing in the Western. It's just a different, it's a different cultural grammar. But the cultural grammar is a constraining force, no matter if it's from the West or from the East. So can we put the Western under society? If that makes you understand it better, be my guest. The 12 global genres that are from StoryGrid were extraordinarily commercially driven and practically created. What that means is that I had to take fiction and come up with 12 categories that were different enough from each other that would have different sort of nuances of convention and obligatory moments and do my best. So if you think Western should be in society, I'm cool with that. I mean, it is about the constraint of the individual. And you can say that about society, family dramas. What's that about? That's about the constraint of agentic figures within a family, where the patriarchy or the matriarchy isn't really so excited about their kids having agency that is stronger than their own. So what do? They constrain the people in their family so that they won't, you know, outshine them. That's like, just use that concept and you can come up with a million freaking stories, right? So it's the same thing, only you substitute the state in terms of a Western. So the state, law and order, so to speak, is constraining individual agentic expression. Yeah.
Okay. All right, so we'll end with this one. I'd like Sean's opinion on how story grid structure breaks down for a short story.
Okay, well, there's a beginning, there's a middle and an end. There are five commandments. There are unexpected events that happen in units of story within the short story. Most short stories can be anywhere from a single scene, 1500 words or so, 900 words, 6 words, or they could be multi-sequence. For example, Raymond Carver's, what is it, A Simple Good Thing or A Something Good Thing, which is a very disturbing short story, but it's very good. It's a sequence of scenes that occurs that has a beginning, middle, and end, and has an extraordinarily paradoxical, painful, and beautiful finale. But you can break that thing down into a sequence of scenes, and you can break each scene into a sequence of beats that all have the five commandments, all have visible and invisible fear gorillas that drive the turning point progressive complications. A short story is it's basically a condensed novel. So all you have to do is write a novel and then push it down into 3,000-4,000 words, and then you're Alice Munro. So it's, you know, people think short stories easier than a novel. I don't know.
All right. And then I'll address the last one we have here. So a couple people asked what our ideas are for the guild next year. So overall, I've been really happy with how the guild has gone. When Sean and I first put together the structure, you know, we'd never done this before. So it was kind of like, well, you know, let's try this and let's try that, and we'll put it together and we'll kind of reach for these goals. And so overall, I feel like we hit the mark pretty well. I'm not quite ready to talk about exactly what we're going to be changing in the new version, but there's kind of two overarching goals I have for 2021, right, for StoryGrid. So the first would be continuing to develop community and connecting writers with each other. So we did that with, you know, the forum and some of these calls, and then we did that with by one of the chat messages. Yes, we're also talking about more merch. We are talking about that. But that's not an overarching goal. So community, and so we're talking, you know, we did that with the sprints as well at the beginning of the quarantine, and we were really happy with some things that came out of that. So we're talking about some ways to infuse some more community, encourage some more community. The second thing would be really focusing on the basics of the StoryGrid methodology. I would love to see, you know, all of the guild members are able to spreadsheet a scene or a novel. All the guild members could fill out a foolscap. All of the guild members could answer the 6 editor core questions for their novel or somebody else's. And so we're starting to do some things that will really focus on that. And we're going to make those, I think, a part of the guild as well. So, so those are kind of the two big things we're focusing on. And we have some ideas of how those are going to be put into play, but I'm not quite 100% ready to say the specifics on that. But again, I'm going to put this in here. So, I just put the link in the chat. If you haven't filled the survey, that's your way to let us know what you would like to see in the future of the guild. It's kind of long, but you know, five, seven minutes to fill it out. And it really will help us as we're making our final decisions about what to do. And we would just love to hear from you on everything. So anyway, we will wrap it up there. So thanks everybody for being a part of this month's Q&A, and hopefully it was helpful, and we will see everybody soon. Thanks everybody.
Bye.